This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Barbara Goldberg is here. She has a new book. It's an award winner. I can see it from here. Give us a poem, Barbara.
Furlough. I love to see those tall, lean, muscular men with their clean-shaven heads and digital watches toss their kids in the air. And I love to see them drop, not weightless, but light as grenades. This is how children learn that fear can be fun, and fathers that this too is hand-to-hand combat. To cradle or kill, what story do we tell ourselves to justify? That a dunam of earth is worth dying for? That a child opening his mouth with an O of pleasure overturns everything? We grow like onions, our heads buried in dirt. And we die like onions, face down in a pot of boiling water. Gravity causes all to fall down, and love to hold things up.
That is Barbara Goldberg, and you can tell by that poem her tone, because she can take pain and pleasure and turn them into story. What is this new book called, Barbara?
Breaking and Entering.
Why did you choose that?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because of course I thought for months, it was in production for months. And you know how you go through poems and try to look for a title from a title of a poem or a phrase in the poem. And this turned up, and nothing was right, and this turned up in the most unexpected place, which is a funny poem about a private eye, which was about breaking an entry and getting an ADT system or whatever. The poem is funny, but the title to me is not. It's kind of like breaking and entering into the unconscious.
That tells us a lot about what we're going to hear. And are you happy with the book?
Oh, yes.
But what's in it?
Everything. Well, not every, it's not a collected.
New and selected.
New and selected. So there's some new poems in there and then selected from the other books.
Now, you have about 6 books in print.
Right.
And are each one of those represented here?
Yes.
Aha. The first time I saw you read was like in 77 or
That's
something.
Probably
at the Folger
true.
Library. And I just opened this book, and I think you were reading Cautionary Tales.
I was reading definitely from that book. I could have read Cautionary
Tales.
And
I'm opening up and I see one here. So this is going to be like an old friend.
Oldies Thank but you. Goodies, hopefully.
So Barbara Goldberg's here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. It's finally open for poets. And I want another poem just to celebrate that.
Well, I thought I'd read a poem that's not at all on the same subject, but does something similar at the end. See if you can see what it is. It's called Marilyn. And it's a poem about Marilyn Monroe. And actually, it was kind of an assignment poem for an anthology on Marilyn poems. And when I learned about it, I thought, why on earth her? Like, I have no association with her at all. And this is why. Marilyn. Had it been me, I never would have chosen her. Too blonde. Too white. Too drop-dead gorgeous. Not to mention her voice, breathy and hesitant. I guess some men like that. Luckily for Marilyn, I'm not a man. Now take Audrey Hepburn. Petite, spiked bangs, French twist, her taste for wit. Someone I could grow into. So many girls like to make themselves stupid or lose on purpose. Like this girl in college. Also blonde, also stacked. She could spin 1,000 angels on the head of a pin. But at parties, she'd drink too much and act dumb. The boys, she said, ate it up. I wouldn't even want a guy like that, who wouldn't know how to spar or crack a joke, who'd simply ache to dive headfirst into her décolletage and sleep in the pillowy softness of her flesh. I preferred those who hoarded secrets, little treasures buried like truffles deep in the underbelly of the earth.
Barbara Goldberg, that is your secret. You get into the depth of life and you pull out the truffles.
Right.
And you know, that's so interesting because it's so like you. You're given an assignment to write about Marilyn. And instead of researching and looking and depicting her, you start arguing about why her. You turn it on its tail. There are so many techniques that are Barbara Goldberg. The way, the witticism in your work, the way you take pain and convert it to something that we can handle, and always the way you bring a poem home. Your end lines, they are your legacy, your end lines. And let's see if I'm telling the truth by hearing another one. This is Breaking and Entering from the Word Works.
So now we're going to get a little personal. And I'm going to read some poems about my father. And this one's called Aluminum. My father loved whatever was new. Like the aluminum pan he brought home one night, dangling it by its ring from his pinky. "Look how light it is," he crowed, glancing with scorn at the cast iron skillet. He never stepped in the kitchen, yet there he was, in a merry mood, frying up bacon. My sister and I were enchanted, perched on a red leatherette chair, swinging our legs. Soon the strips, pale and pink as the skin under a scab, were trembling in a pot of grease. Then my father swirled the pan so the bacon wouldn't stick, spilling fat onto the burner. That's how light it was, the pan. Flames shot up to the ceiling. It stayed black until the painters came. I don't remember who cleaned up the mess, only that he didn't lose his temper at me for being a chatterbox, or my sister for chewing her braids, and he didn't hit us either. Even he couldn't blame the pan, only the hand that held it.
So much there about a relationship. And we make much about the relationship of fathers in literature with men, but we really should be talking about women, because that's how we get our idea of how we will be treated later. And you do make sure that we know he's complex.
Yes.
There's no cruelty in him, but there is an authority that when you and I were raised, that our fathers were authoritarian.
Well, definitely, and especially since he escaped Europe during World War II, and he was German, and he was like Prussian, you know, very... And at that time, there was such a formality between parent and child, not at all like American parents. So it was a different culture, and I felt raised in a different culture. I didn't really feel 100% American.
And you're so wild. How did that happen? That's called reactionary. No, but truly, do you think compression helps the artist?
You know, I was thinking about that the other day, because in terms of my poetry, I think I'm really a storyteller. Every poem kind of has a narrative, but it's not fiction. I mean, it is fiction and it isn't fiction, but I think the compression is what really draws me to the art, because you have to put it, you know, all in. And I remember Bill Stafford when he came to university and I read something and he said, "Thank you for your novel." Wasn't that lovely?
Yes, you put a whole novel
in. I put a whole novel in.
Well, but you say you just realized you're telling a story.
Yes,
but we all knew it. We've known it for 50 years that you're a storyteller. And if you are telling the same story over and over in 6 books, what is that story? Because we all tell, Camus says, we all tell the same story. And if someone said, "What are your themes in your work?" to me, I said, "There's just one theme."
What's that?
Well, in mine is domesticity, and it is about being a military wife. But do you think you're autobiographical?
Well, some, but then I go back in history and I have different characters.
That's right about you.
You know, I wrote about 11th century whatever, an Italian Renaissance. I enjoy that because you need to do research and I can kind of take myself out of it. But it's always there.
But the feelings and Berta. Same. Don't you think they're your feelings?
I do. Here's something weird. I kind of was looking when I was putting this together. I have a lot of longer narratives. These longer narratives always include two women, one man. This is not a ménage à trois, unless in the most, you know, elemental terms. And then I realized, well, it was my sister and me. And so that's where, and
there
we were so
is.
Different, but we were both kind of eager for the attention of our parents. And it seems to me, I don't know if this is true, but it felt to me like my parents split us up. My father took my sister, and my mother took me, mainly because we looked similar.
Same here. Same here. I was my mother's favorite. My father had his own.
And you had a sense of that as a child?
Are you kidding? I was in agony. Because she got my father. But the thing is, I'm interested in the imprimatur of the triangle. That is the very essence of theater. The triangle is the very essence of theater. And so that's why there's so much energy in your work. Because it's there, it's embedded, it's not obvious. But let's hear another one, and we'll see. Barbara Goldberg is here with an astonishing collection of her life between covers, breaking and entering.
That's nice. The next poem I'll read is called Star. It's again about my father. I have a million mother poems, which I'll save for another broadcast. But the poem Star is interesting because if you remember that they escaped out of Europe because of the Holocaust, then this is an odd little touch. Star. It was a silver star with the word liar stamped on it. And my father made me wear it because I was one. He knew I hadn't taken my bath, just turned the faucets on, knew my scrapbook on Brazil was overdue, two pictures of the Amazon pasted on the cover. Spinning stories to wiggle out of things made him madder, one deceit compounding another, especially since my father was a man of his word, and his word was gold. I was glad when he died. And could let Danny feel me up with no one the wiser. Glad he didn't see me run through his money like a woman bent on ruination. If only he could have lied a little, he who had so little charm, so little social grace. But for him, truth was absolute, was never gray. As for me, there are so many truths. It's hard to tell the one big one that underlies them all. I loved my father, love him even more today, though he was mean and cut me down to size, and I was small to begin with. He left me bare of subterfuge, without a leg to stand on, but my own.
Barbara, I love the honesty of that. But do you find that after writing poems about your father for 30 years and all those wet leaves dry and float away that you find out he was really wonderful?
Well, yes, that he had many, many flaws. But don't
we
all? But
what did he do for you? But did he do some things for you?
Well, he died when I was 14, which led to a whole different kind of life for myself that would have happened. He never lived through my teenage years. So he never met any of my boyfriends. I say that because I don't think he would have been sympathetic to them. And the other thing, I think the demand for perfection, although that can be,
I think you have that.
Well, definitely in poetry.
Oh, you definitely
do. Anywhere.
I just am so glad I'm not your editor. Really, if you'll agonize over a comma.
That's as true.
Don't I know it? Barbara Goldberg. But what does it take to tell the truth?
I think, truth be told, it takes a lot of self-awareness. I did a lot of work for that. I mean, you know, I worked for that so that I would begin to understand what was me, what was baggage from my parents. They both had in very different ways. But I think you have to be self-aware and be able to separate out. Otherwise, I don't think you can get anywhere to see your parents as individual human beings, like they did the best they could.
But you're such a fabulous craft person. I mean, you were made to be a poet and a dramatist because you are so meticulous with the line length, the lyricism, the repetitiveness. You use every skill. They're all embedded, so we don't see them showing off. But the craft, that's the Prussian in you. You should say thank you, Father.
Thank you, Dad.
Okay. And we say thank you for being here because we want to hear another thing. I want to tell everyone that she has taught at the American, at
yes.
the Writer Center.
Yes.
And that you have gone to school. Name your colleges. Columbia?
Mount Holyoke. That was the seminary, the female seminary.
But it was pretty classy.
Yeah, that's true.
Columbia
Yeshiva for a master's in education for the disadvantaged. That's a part of me not many people know that I taught. After Robert Kennedy was killed, I went right there.
And I had no idea, and I thought I knew every wrinkle on your elbow.
And then, let's see what else. Oh, and then American U for the MFA.
Yes, and where did you teach other than the Writer Center?
I taught a little bit at Georgetown, but I taught speech writing. Mm-hmm. And let's see. Well, I taught at PS in the what they used to call then Spanish Harlem. And my children.
Well, today you're our poet and not our teacher, but in a way we're learning a lot. So go on into this book, Breaking and Entering.
Well, this is a funny one. We haven't had. Well, you know what? At the end, it is.
But there's
funny.
Humor in every
I
one of yours.
I was just going to say.
You are so clever. You slip it in.
So this is a poem called Girl Trades Baby for Prom Dress. Do you remember in the days when you went to the supermarket and the National Enquirer was right by the cashier?
It still is.
Is it? Okay. Well, this was a headline, and I thought, whoa, that's pretty, you know, that's pretty fantastic. So Girl Trades Baby for Prom Dress. National Enquirer. So I thought, oh, this is definitely a poem, but I was kind of stuck on it until a friend of mine said, Barbara, imagine the dress, and then I was fine. How smug we feel, we who measure want in dollops, but imagine her wanting to distraction and to be so trapped. That's how much she wants the blue chiffon with blue spaghetti straps, blue rose pinned to her waist, and shoes dyed to match. She wants the gardenia wristlets to dance under the bluest moon, a chance to be elected queen, to neck in a rented limousine. A horse isn't hers to give, nor gold, nor tea. Kings would have traded more, been called heroic. When Anna abandoned Serge, wasn't she tragic? These days I feel my own parched throat, the bedrock crumbling. For the fecundity of your embrace, I too would pay, and dearly.
Oh, how you bring it home, how you bring it home. Nobody knows but me that you are the head speechwriter at AARP, which like has 1 million members.
It's
and
true.
Were you the speechwriter for the president?
Well, there's a CEO, and there's the president, and there's the board.
And all of that was yours?
Well, there was more than one.
And being a poet and taking this
easy,
job.
Easy breezy. It's the best job for a poet, my goodness.
But if they gave you a topic, how did you get your head to be persuasive rather than silky? How do you do that?
Well, the trick there is also to compress a lot of information. And you had to interview the people, the relevant people, to get the information. I spent a lot of time on the lead. I've quoted Lucille Clifton. I used my
poetry in.
Yeah, put it in there. And it's easy because it's the voice. You know, a lot of people, press releases are not the voice. And so...
You mean you adapt the voice of the person
yes,
you're writing for?
Yes, it's like a monologue. So I suggest poets look into that. Seriously.
Well, they might not be able to gain such a high level of speech writing, but you did that for what, 5 years?
I think it was 10.
And how many speeches do you think you wrote?
Oh, my God, it was something like 300 a year. Horrible.
Barbara.
Well, a lot of them were like introductions
sure.
where you had to be original introducing someone, funerals, graduation, but most of them were you know, had a lot of heavy-duty information.
Yes, AARP is extremely powerful and wants you to know it.
It's
so
true.
You had to do that.
This is true.
But I love your poetry best.
Oh,
so
thank
go
you.
Back to it. Barbara Goldberg, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're so happy to be at the library.
I'm going to read There for the Grace. There for the Grace.
Thank
of course
you.
I'm going to, I should save that for closing, actually. Well, you'll see why it's all about you. I forgot to say that I taught at AU. I taught Anna Karenina forever.
Yeah, more than once?
More than once.
She didn't die just once?
No.
Every time?
Every time.
But do you know what I feel about her and a lot of others? The men that wrote the books about the women who committed adultery always killed the women at the end.
But this is true. However,
Madame Bovary.
This is true.
They always killed them.
But think of this. Tolstoy was like the first to write about a birth scene from the woman's point of view. So that's, you know, he had to really
we'll give
have.
Him that.
I have to give him that.
But
yes,
in Russia,
they
did it in front of everyone. They gave birth in front of 15 people.
Yeah, but no one who did it before him. And that's why I'm saying when people say, well, only write what you know. Well, Tolstoy didn't write what he knew. I mean, he could make a leap of the imagination.
You could have been cool. What other things did you teach? Just Anna Karenina?
No, I taught Updike and I taught Colette. I had to have
did
a
you
woman
choose
in there.
What you wanted to
yeah.
teach?
Yeah, I was. And poetry, of course, I taught poetry. I'd always start off with a Sharon Olds poem, which really kind of knocks you between the guts. And the first poem I would teach, oh, this is terrible to say, was on divorce, because I figured like 80% of the kids in my class came from divorce. So anyway, that's...
What a demograph.
Right.
Oh, so speechwriter, translator, poet, she's ours.
There for the Grace. Ah, that came from a newspaper headline. Do you remember years ago when there was a cruise ship and, I don't know, somehow it was taken over and they dumped a man in a wheelchair into the sea? Do you remember that? Leon somebody or other. Well, this poem comes from that. There for the grace of God, there for the grace, there for the window the housekeeper carelessly left ajar, for the five-year-old boy who fell from the 53rd floor, there for the musician, his father, and his guitar, there for the mother, and there for the cruise ship out for a cruise, for the crippled whose wheelchair was pushed and tumbled down into the Mediterranean, there for the blue of the sea, of the starling and finch and the hyacinth, there for the lover who follows the script, who touches the lips, and within the mystère, there for the sweet inhalation of breath, for the arm casually raised to brush back the hair, there for the grace of God, for the grace of earth, we go.
We must honor the list. The list is powerful. Just the way, and is it anaphora? Do you start every line with there? Or sometimes you say, and there, right? You don't start every line with there.
No, I don't. By the way, I wrote the poem in like a minute. This is a gift poem, except for one line. And of course, that took 2 years. I couldn't get the rhythm right. You know, and I was going crazy. This is a terrific poem. And one line is missing.
What is the line?
The line is... The Mediterranean, there for the blue.
And pushed, that's the best one.
Oh, yeah, really. Was pushed and tumbled down into, and then the Mediterranean, there for the blue. This poem
you
has
needed
a lot.
That,
yeah, I needed
beat.
The, exactly. How did I know? I don't know.
Oh, I'm just loving this insight into your work. Oh, we have to mention you as a translator because you have really made a name there. And I think there's been five books in Hebrew poems that you've translated, and then an anthology of Hebrew poems.
There's been two books with single poets,
and
then the anthologies. But I have to say, I had an Israeli husband, and he was giving me the literal from the Hebrew because I don't speak Hebrew. That always knocks people's socks off. How can you translate if you don't speak the language? And my feeling is if you're a poet, you can translate a poem written in any language. Because you use the same skills. it's a different language and you have to kind of, but get into it like I do into character. So you have to kind of dive into the culture and the sounds and
marry
like
the
that.
Guy.
And you, and well, yeah, but
you went
right.
All in. You went all in.
Listen, I'm not the first. There are other translators who married their translators. There are other poets
but
who have married their
translators. Since Moshe Dor was himself an elevated poet, when he went on the literal level, wasn't that good enough?
Oh, no. It was dead meat, as I like to call it.
Didn't he lyricize it? Because he needed another perspective?
It's not poetry.
Oh,
if you go literally, it's like
the
worst.
But he was a poet.
Yes, I know, but he said, and he spoke fluent English, but he would never dream of translating a poem of his. He would do essays and things like that, but for a poem, you need a poet.
And you need an English poet for English poetry.
I believe so.
And that took up a big segment of your life.
It did.
Yeah, and you are pretty well known as the foremost translator of Hebrew right now, that in poetry.
I believe
on your blog.
On my blog.
That I know.
In my condominium community. No, there are many others now, luckily, because there are other, there are a lot of people
it's
who
so
live
necessary.
In Israel. Yes.
Listen, we don't know each other, Barbara. That's about all this. We don't know other cultures. If poetry does not cross that bridge, who will?
Well, you're right, and I regard myself as fortunate in that I grew up in a bilingual home. So therefore,
what was the other language?
German.
And do you speak German?
I do terrible German, mm-hmm. A child's German.
Well, then don't write poetry in German.
I don't.
Just give us some more in English, please.
Okay.
Translator, speechwriter, mother.
Well, this is funny. This is from a book I wrote that's a feminist fable. I was so tired of the men going out and doing the deeds and then coming back and being heroes. So in this particular suite of poems, it's a woman who goes out and does all sorts of feats and then comes back and it becomes queen. But first she has to do these things in order to become queen. She starts off a princess. And the title of this poem, I just gave you, is No Small Feat. And through this poem, there's a lot of punning. Somebody once asked, who do you write poems for? And somebody answered, for myself, a few friends, and God. Well, I mean, my feeling is if I don't delight myself, then why am I doing it? And if I don't surprise myself, why am I doing it? I don't think everyone feels that way. It's me. So this is my, so no small feat. How do you spell it?
Yes, I hope it's F-E-A-T, but
it
I don't
is,
know.
It is, it is.
With you,
yeah.
Who knows?
No small feat for grief to doff his mourning cloak, the velvet heft of it, and the scarlet knot emblazoned in cross stitches, insignia for not enough. He might easily have kept it on, remaining wrapped in sorrow, for surely there is enough sorrow in this world to dwell in. If we could earn a crown for every soul we found shrouded in despair, why, we'd be richer than a dozen kings, which explains why moths grow fat and tailors are by nature cheerful, day in, day out, their nimble fingers stitching habits of our own choosing.
Barbara Goldberg, talk a little bit about why tailors are happy. Because they have work they love?
Well, they have to suit what they make to the person. So that requires a certain amount of negative capability, you know, of being able to put yourself
in. And why do moths get fat?
Well, because there are so many tailors who are making mistakes that there's extra cloth and the moths are eating it.
That's
I've never been
deep.
Asked that before.
That's deep. Or that stuck. Because, you know, usually every line of yours is just a little diamond in itself. And then, so these little diamonds were so, they just stuck out to me. And I had to explicate, as we say.
Did you get the other puns?
Oh, tell me one.
Okay. So one is his mourning cloak.
Oh, got that one.
Okay. And the other one is wrapped in sorrow. Wrapped.
Of course.
Yes.
And did you spell it wrapped or wrapped?
R-A-P-T.
Okay. Well, you'll do anything. You'll just do anything to get a good poem. We do want a final poem from you, and I can't tell you how happy you make me.
Oh, gosh,
I can't tell you how much I believe in poetry, because it is the most human thing I know.
Yeah, I...
Without it, life would just be going to the store.
My mother said, of all the arts, why poetry? And I said, Mom, because it pays the least. No, I didn't say that.
My father used to say, there's no lack of work to do in the world if you're willing to get nothing for it. That was his
wonderful
part. That was, yeah, but it was about me and my art. Okay, let's
beautiful.
Hear a last beautiful poem.
Gourmand's Prayer. Yellow-tailed snapper with citrus beurre blanc, filet mignon in demi-glace cabernet, roast duck garnished with mint-jellied peaches, angels on horseback, dates stuffed with garlic cloves wrapped in bacon and served in a hot honey pepper sauce, bananas Foster, key lime pie, dense flourless chocolate cake drizzled with raspberry coulis. Lord, grant me the power to well digest all that I have well eaten.
The voice of Barbara Goldberg, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the library for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, Sandy Jackson Cohen, and the Anne Arundel Arts Council. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.